This is
the
Second Story
Podcast.
Welcome back to the Second Story Podcast. I'm Max Spitz. In storytelling, there are often patterns and structures that we use to shape real events as we craft our stories. Looking at something in hindsight frequently gives us a different perspective on something that happened. The understanding of something as momentous or a true turning point, though it may have felt gradual or even mundane in the actual moment it happened. As you'll hear in this story, there are major events, pregnancy, miscarriage, divorce, that the storyteller doesn't truly recognize as climactic as she lives them. Rather, she experiences them each as one small moment within many larger ones, just one step in life that leads to the next step. Recorded live at Haymarket Pub and Brewery in Chicago in January 2024, Second Story is proud to present Resolve.
Our relationship was ending, but we still went out for our 8-year anniversary. 3 years before, I'd been pregnant on our anniversary, but I wasn't anymore. He sat across from me and I stared at him, at his wrinkled eyes, his freckles, the shape of his shoulders and the blue button-up he wore to every special occasion. I brought the gift card from your birthday party, I ventured, and the conversation forced itself on. Yet by the end of the night, some of the tension had broken. Your laugh, he said, putting a hand on his heart. I wondered if we were both thinking if this would be one of our last memories, but I decided not to ask. Fast forward 3 months, and I'm in a tangle of boxes in my new apartment. It is so quiet. Time is so elastic. None of the breakup stories have mentioned this. The day I moved out, I had gotten the assignment. I felt empowered, happy, brave as the U-Haul pulled away from my old place. Snow glittered in the sun. I had reached that perfect apex after all those years of conflict, the rising action at last launching me into my resolution. The room darkens around me, casting the boxes in shadow. The evening sky turns black-blue through the window, and my stomach a familiar ache grows. I check the time, 6:04. He is not coming, I remind myself, my stomach folding and unfolding itself into knots. I check again, 6:10. No one is coming home anymore between 6:20 and 7. What is the narrative for resolution when nothing seems resolved? It's nighttime and I'm a child. I'm in bed and hear my parents arguing. While I'm never so sure about the words, I know the shape of it, its volume, the rise and the fall, the tension the next day. But then again, there are also happy moments, especially on other nights when my mom and I would watch I Love Lucy together, propped up on pillows in her bed, laughing and laughing as Ricky yelled at Lucy, as Lucy sought revenge. And sometimes my dad wouldn't be mad if I was up past my bedtime. Sometimes he would stand in the doorway, smiling. Your boobs look huge, babe, he said to me after our 7-year anniversary. He was turning the TV on from the couch, watching me through the doorway as I took off my dress and threw it on the bed. When had this happened? How could it have happened without my noticing? Marry me, he said, after the pregnancy test confirmed it. It was the first and last time he would mention it. I had imagined this moment for so long, but all I felt was dread. I'm in my new apartment, unpacking boxes in my writing room. Books are spilling out of open suitcases. Novels, slung volumes of poems are scattered all over the floor. There's a beat-up printer paper box full of my old diaries, which I've kept since I was 8. It dawns on me. I've been writing or trying to write for 24 years, exactly 3/4 of my life. And over all that time, no genre has stuck so close to me than that of a difficult man. Brooding, moody, bad-tempered, and changeable, I have seen this man everywhere, in real life and in literature. Jane Eyre's Mr. Rochester, Sylvia Plath's Ted, and there was Lucy and Desi as well, who balanced the troubles of their real marriage with the perfection of their TV one. I open a writing guide, flipping through pages and pages on conflict, how to establish them, develop them, complicate them. But for resolution, there's just a few paragraphs, where, on the one hand, it's defined as tying up loose ends, and on the other, it's also referred as denouement, which is French for untying them. I'm 6 weeks pregnant and I can't sleep, which is nothing new, but the stakes seem higher now. I'm sleeping for 2. I go into the living room. The coffee table is a constellation of empty Coke cans, candy wrappers, and salad plates with crusted on ketchup. I sigh, something for the next day. He's on the couch, barely awake, but not quite asleep. I turn off the TV. He blinks his eyes open. Can we go to bed now? I ask, wasting no time. Please? I can hear it. I'm nagging. The TV wasn't even that loud, he answers, but it's just not that. I'm also thinking that when he's done, there'll be the back door slamming, then the bathroom door, the fridge door, and the bumps in the box, and the fox he snarls before bed, and then all over again in the morning. Don't be such a cunt, all right? I reply to myself. Imitating him was something I started doing towards the end, employing an insane logic that's less hurtful if I'm the one saying it, or graciously taking on the labor of fighting me myself so he doesn't have to. He laughs, as he usually does, and we slip into bed. He falls asleep immediately. I listen to the rise and the fall of his breath. The next morning, I take my prenatal vitamin. I love being pregnant, the clarity of purpose, my responsibilities doled out week by week. Last week was the baby's limb buds. This week it's the dents where the ears and the heart will be. It's the first time in my life I'm interested in breakfast, so I make myself oatmeal and eggs. I eat spoonfuls of yogurt and also a banana as I read blog after blog on if the fetus is the size of an eyelash, a lentil, and how it'll grow into the size of a baked bean, a pickle, and then into a baby. My excitement swells. I start cleaning the coffee table, bending down to collect the Coke cans, the plates, the candy wrappers, going back and forth from the living room to the kitchen. It's not so bad, until it is. In my mind's eye, I see myself with a big pregnant belly, struggling to bend down and wipe the glass coffee table with a rag, and then again with a baby on my hip, and one more time as an old woman, alone, surrounded by a mess that's not hers. It's easy to pin it on the genre of the difficult man. But I'm starting to realize that there's a strong woman behind him that enables him. My heart pounds as I schedule an abortion online for the day after my first prenatal appointment. It's better to cancel it than not have it at all, I reason with myself. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. I miscarry a few days later at 7.5 weeks. It's nighttime and I'm a teenager. I hear my parents arguing, the rise and the fall. From my bookshelf, I pull out Jane Eyre. Just like Jane and Mr. Rochester, my parents' marriage is normal, I reason to myself. Their age gap, their power struggles, these were the building blocks for passion, the scenes and arcs of lifelong love. It's a sign of strength for a woman who, as Charlotte Bronte wrote, stands so quiet and grave at the mouth of hell. Was it any surprise that I turned 23 and fallen in love with someone older than me? Someone who yelled but was tender as well. Every woman adores a fascist, Sylvia Plath wrote in her book, Ariel. Not because we were tricked into this adoration, but because we wanted to. He was familiar, as charming as he was volatile. But strong women have the energy and the patience, the brilliance and the bravery to stay. And stay and stay and stay and stay, and cycles can turn into arcs this way. The difficult man healed at last. The woman self-actualized upon becoming a spouse, a mother. To keep him close, Lucille Ball built Desi Arnaz a television empire. It's been 4 months since losing the baby at the end of an exhausting week. We eat pizza and watch what he wants to watch on TV. I long to zone out with a belly full of cheese and a brain so empty, but something nags at me. A writing cramp, due at midnight. I go to the back room, my writing room, where I mostly store things and fold the laundry. I wince. What do I say on my personal statement? That it had been easier to be in love, that I hadn't bothered to be anything else. That without my noticing, I had forgotten who I was, that what I want in life matters too. It's only thanks to Second Story, this beautiful person right here, that I even have a writing sample, that I click submit at 12:03. I win the grant a week before his birthday and cash the check on the way to pick up his cake, a spring in my step. For the first time in months, I'm happy. I see you plotting to get out of here, he says to me one night. I'm surprised by this and go all out on his birthday party, inviting 40 of his family members and friends. I want him to know how loved he is, I've written in my diary. There's an ink stain before what comes next, like I pause before writing. I think I also want to tell him goodbye. It'll be your turn next, his aunt says to us, bruising by our table at a sister's wedding. I've stopped manifesting that, I say flatly. I don't care what I do. I have never felt this sick before, and it's nearing 3 a.m. Can we go home, please? It is just like you to make my sister's day all about you, he says, leaving me alone. It's only after his aunt tells him that I'm actually unwell that we climb into a taxi and go home. The test confirms it. I have COVID. I feel relief at the chance to isolate in the quiet. I watched Amy Poehler's documentary on Lucy and Desi. An interviewee says, and I'm paraphrasing here, what people often forget is that Lucy and Desi were happily married to other people for far longer than they were married to each other. This floors me. A whole other story. Not one that resolves into staying, but one where there's resolve to go forward. I didn't do it right away, Lucy says, just the audio of her voice from when she was older, wise and wry and raspy, not at all like Lucy Ricardo's. I planned for a year before I sent him the divorce papers. My diary is too far away, so I write into my notes app, the time has come to leave. It's been 15 months away from him. 15 months of falling action, wondering when the real resolution will come. In my writing room, Jane Eyre, Ariel, and I Love Lucy DVDs are neatly arranged on the shelves. I sit at my writing desk, tying and untying these threads of grief and love, resolving and re-resolving this story again and again. I reflect on all the ways it could have ended. I could have stayed, or I could have left and come back, or in another timeline, I would have a 2-year-old on my lap. Sunshine filters through the window, a rainbow of color passes through the glass. It is so quiet. Time is so elastic. I start running.
This story was produced by Emma Kester, curated by Lizzie Dazinski, and directed by RJ Silva. Music and sound engineering was by Mike Benedict. The Second Story podcast is produced by Max Spitz. To be the first to hear about updates and new episodes, sign up for our podcast listserv at 2ndstory.com/podcast or subscribe to the Second Story podcast on SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. Second Story is located in the traditional homelands of the Council of the Three Fires, the Odawa, Ojibwe, and Potawatomi Nations. Our programming is made possible by the Arts Work Fund, Walter Foundation, Paul M. Angel Family Foundation, Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, Illinois Arts Council Agency, the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, Innovation 80, the Field Foundation, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, Modern Compassionate Care, Eric Rothstein and Gina Wamick, Athene Karras and Thomas Applegate, James Lupo, Jessica Wetmore, Hannah and George Stowe, and many generous individuals like you. I'm Max Spitz, and
this is
the Second
Story
Podcast.